This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Millie wird bei uns einziehen.
Hallo?
Basierend auf dem weltweiten Bestseller.
Soll ich Ihnen alles zeigen? Sie sollen sich hier sicher fühlen. Das tue ich.
Mit Sydney Sweeney.
Sie sind meine Rettung. Was würde ich nur ohne Sie tun?
Und Amanda Seyfried. The Housemaid, wenn sie wüsste. Ab 15. Januar im Kino.
Willkommen zu Krypto für Anfänger. Schritt 1. Versprich der Welt das Paradies. Schritt 2. Erfinde eine Währung auf Basis der Blockchain. Schritt 3. Scheiß auf die Blockchain, behalte das Geld. Schritt 4. Wenn alles zusammenbricht, verschwindest du. Oder Take the Money and Run im ZDF. Jetzt streamen.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
This was election year in dozens of other countries around the world. A few months ago, we looked ahead to some of them, and in particular to the South African and Indian elections. And it's fair to say that neither of them went as the ruling parties had hoped, or as many observers expected. So today, we're following up on those results and the immediate aftermath in both hugely important countries. What happens next in India and South Africa? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First to South Africa, where May's election took place 30 years after the African National Congress came to power with Nelson Mandela as their leader. The ANC had enjoyed a majority of votes and seats ever since, but not anymore. To find out what happened and what it means for South African politics, I'm joined by David Everett, professor at the Wits School of Governance in Johannesburg, and Dr. Aisha Omar, who is a British Academy International Fellow at SOAS. Aisha Omar, could you just give us the headline results of what actually happened in the South African elections?
For the first time since the end of apartheid in 1994, the African National Congress, the ANC, has failed to secure an outright majority, receiving only 40.18% of the vote. This has resulted in the ANC's losing its 30-year dominance on South African politics and necessitated the formation of a coalition government, or what is now being described as a government of national unity. Insofar as opposition gains, the Democratic Alliance, or the DA, has maintained its position as the second largest party with 22% of the vote. Most significantly in this election, the newly formed Nkonto Sizwe party, associated with former President Jacob Zuma, emerged as a formidable force, securing 14.58% of the vote, which in a PR system translates into 58 seats in the South African parliament. And while the ANC retained majorities in 5 of 9 provinces, it lost ground in key areas, including Gauteng, the country's economic heartland.
The Zuma party, Mkhonto, that's called MK for short, is it?
Yes, it's called MK.
What was the turnout?
Despite a record 27 million South Africans registering to vote, only 16 million votes were actually cast. So the election saw a record low voter turnout of 58%, which continues a downward trend in electoral participation in South Africa. The low turnout reflects concerns in South Africa over voter apathy and disillusionment with the political process.
And in very broad terms, is that also why the ANC did so badly?
That's quite a complex question, David, because what we see generally, or what we observe with liberation movements across Southern Africa, is that they commonly face the crisis of legitimacy as they approach or surpass their third decade in power. And this is evident in Namibia with SWAPO, in Zimbabwe with ZANU-PF. With the ANC, in my view, several reasons may ostensibly account for their loss. These include, for example, the fact that many voters, especially in poorer and rural areas, feel that the ANC has failed to deliver on promises of economic emancipation and service delivery. Then there's ongoing corruption scandals that have eroded trust in the ANC's leadership. And youth factor, younger voters with no personal memory of apartheid are also less swayed by the ANC's historical role and turning to more radical alternatives like the EFF.
David Everett, when we broadcast the programme about this election back in March, the view was that if the ANC's vote just dipped below the 50%, then they'd be able to form a coalition with one of the minor parties, and that not be a huge deal. but if it went down towards 40%, then they'd have to ally with one of the bigger opposition parties. We've talked about the MK party of Jacob Zuma. Can you remind us about the other big parties?
The formal opposition is the Democratic Alliance, which got 22%. That's a fairly conservative, middle-of-the-road, economically liberal party, which believes in an open economy, minimal rights for the workers and so on, and is ideologically quite distinct from the ANC. The other one would be the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF, which was proclaiming this as their moment. They crept in eventually with 10%, and they call themselves a socialist emancipatory revolutionary movement. They have a vision of an omnipotent state with a bottomless purse.
David, where did the ANC vote go? Did it mostly go to the MK party of Zuma?
Quite clearly, a lot of it did. And for the ANC to drop 18 points, a lot of voters did desert it for other parties. Initially, I think the expectation was that they would either go a more conservative route towards the Democratic Alliance or a more radical route, if you like, towards the Economic Freedom Fighters. But when Umkhonto weSizwe, MK, was launched, it rapidly became what it is now seen to be, which is a party of those who had been named in the State Capture Commission report, who had been involved in insurrection, an attempted insurrection in 2021, who'd been close to Jacob Zuma. Many of them have been in the dock in court facing various charges.
So essentially state capture is what we would generally call corruption.
We had a very long commission of inquiry into state capture, which Jacob Zuma had been forced to institute in his last couple of months in office, that detailed all the money that had disappeared, which is basically $70 billion had vanished from our economy.
The person who was most identified with that corruption was Jacob Zuma himself. Is he allowed to sit in Parliament at all now?
No, you are not allowed to have a criminal charge that was successfully brought against you for the 5 years prior to the sitting. So he was banned from taking up a seat in Parliament.
Aisha, who is now in the government and how did they get there?
The parties that initially agreed to be part of the government of national unity was the Democratic Alliance and several other smaller parties.
How difficult, Aisha, was it to form the coalition? What were the discussions and what were the compromises that had to be reached?
What we've observed in the last few weeks, and just a few days ago with President Ramaphosa's announcement of his cabinet, is that there were lots of behind-the-scenes disputes taking place over cabinet allocations, over ideological divergences, over questions about the proportional representation and how that should reflect with regards to the cabinet. The process has also been further complicated, I must say, by a lot of public scrutiny and the questions around market volatility and political uncertainty.
David Everett, I can't quite understand why the smaller parties have to be involved at all. If my maths is right, the ANC got 40% and the Democratic Alliance got 22%. Why do they need these smaller parties at all?
Oh, I think they need them because Ramaphosa is playing a really clever strategic hand. He doesn't want to go into a coalition with one other party, face off on almost every issue. Aisha's quite right, but I think a lot of the disputation is happening within the ANC. It's not just between the ANC and its coalition partners. And I think that was the big fight that Ramaphosa had to win. And I think he's made a gamble, which is go for the center, make sure you're market friendly, ally yourself with a whole range of parties that cover your bases. So, for example, the Pan-Africanist Congress, the PAC, which was in exile with the ANC and is famous for its views on land. They have one MP, but that MP is now the Minister of Land Affairs. So the notion that you would give land affairs to the DA, the Democratic Alliance, which is seen as a white party, that now won't happen. And he's able to shuffle people around really cleverly. And he's banking on this working, because if the markets work and the economy begins to grow, it begins to answer the overwhelmingly number one question, which is where are the jobs that we need? The whole rhetoric in the ANC has been, are we going to unify or are we going to get rid of the corrupt elements? And I think he's made the play now, we're getting rid of the corrupt elements. I'm going for a centrist. Government of National Unity is of course, reaching from our historical playbook. But I think it's a brilliant strategic move from him.
How important is it, David, that the Democratic Alliance leader is actually white? And is the party mainly white or it's just the leader?
The critics of the DA all call them a white party. They haven't been terribly good on race and they have fired a succession of very prominent black leaders. And so they do play into the stereotype rather badly. That's what would have cost Ramaphosa a lot of goodwill in the ANC. How can you bring this party into the fold? But he carried the day.
David, can you give us an example of a policy that might otherwise have been put forward by a majority ANC government that would be changed under this coalition?
It's difficult to answer because we haven't seen the extent to which the other parties are willing to concede. But for example, in the run-up to the election, Ramaphosa signed a bill for national health insurance, which has been very strongly opposed by particularly the Democratic Alliance on the argument that it's unaffordable, it'll allow more corruption, et cetera, et cetera. But with the Democratic Alliance now in government, will it change? Will it now say, well, we're now able to have direct oversight on this, and therefore we will either mute our complaints or we'll silence them altogether? He also announced a basic income grant, which is basically the dole. Again, the DA's policy position is entirely opposed to that. And I think these are issues that are going to be much more interesting to watch because they're not just going to be government versus opposition. It's going to be within the government itself that these issues have to be fought out.
Let me make sure I've understood you. One of the things you seem to be saying is that one of the reasons why the Democratic Alliance opposed some of these measures was because they believed they would be corruptly applied, and that actually, now it's in government, if it has oversight over them, it might actually agree to them.
Yes, it might. I mean, I'm not saying it will. I mean, the concept of national health insurance is clearly one that everyone would want. There were two sets of objections. The one was, this is unwieldy, you haven't thought it out, the policy is not very well developed. But the one that came out loudest was, you know, when the state becomes the entity that procures all health for everyone, and you have a state that has been in state capture, as we talked about earlier, you become very shrill about the issue of corruption. But when you're in government and you are literally sitting in cabinet watching what's happening, it's very difficult to maintain that level of public concern unless you're willing to point the finger at yourself as well. That's why it's such a clever strategic move.
Aisha, that very much takes us to the question of President Ramaphosa's position as president. Is he more or less vulnerable in the coalition than he was before?
I think that's a really important question and remains to be seen what's going to happen to Ramaphosa personally, because he does have some allegations of corruption as regards the Palapala scandal on his farm. And this report was tabled in Parliament previously, and the ANC used its majority to block it from an impeachment. The opposition parties, the MK party and the EFF, have vowed to bring this back into the Parliament and to agitate to remove Ramaphosa at all costs.
Aisha, could you just very briefly remind us what the Palapala scandal was?
The Palapala scandal refers to a controversial incident involving the president. Ramaphosa had stored money on his personal game farm in Limpopo, quite a large sum of foreign currency in US dollars. This money was stolen from Ramaphosa's farm, and this theft was not reported to the police at the time, leading to accusations that Ramaphosa attempted to cover up the incident because he had not declared that he had been keeping large amounts of foreign currency. As we know, that's illegal.
David Everett, how popular is Ramaphosa in the country?
Among political leaders, he's got easily the highest approval ratings and the lowest negative ratings out of every other politician we have. And going into the election, he was, in effect, the only real asset that the ANC had.
And how have international investors looked at the foundation of the founding of the coalition government? Have they been broadly supportive of it and put money in?
Yes. The worry was, you go the wrong way and the rand will tank, and you go the right way and it'll strengthen. During the negotiation process, it was like a yo-yo, depending on who was leaking which bit about the negotiations. Once he announced on Sunday night, the rand began to strengthen immediately. The markets all picked up. And that's exactly the game that he's playing. That's what he's betting on.
You've given Ramaphosa credit for being quite canny in the setting up of the coalition. But that's a different question as to whether or not it will work. Do you think it will?
It is extremely important that it does work, because he has banked the country on this gamble. If the investors are there now, if this goes the wrong way, they're not necessarily going to come rushing back to South Africa. We're not that popular. Will it work? Yes, I think it will, because everyone has now got something to lose. All of those parties were claiming that they could do this well, that they could do it better than the ANC. And so he's given them all, almost all, a stake in the pie. And he said, right, make it work.
That was David Everett and Aisha Omar. And just before we move on to India, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one asking what's happening in Sudan as war continues to rage, the one which asks how much trouble universities are in, and the one on how assisted dying is working abroad. Back now to the elections of others. In India, the world's biggest democracy, the election took place over 6 weeks between April and June. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's BJP party also failed to win a majority for the first time since he came to power in 2014. What happened? And what now? I'm joined by Rohan Venkat, editor of the India Inside Out newsletter, and Louise Tillin, professor of politics in the India Institute at King's College London. Rohan Venkat, can you give us the headline results from the Indian election, please? Who got what?
Yeah, so the key number to remember here is 272, which is the halfway mark of India's Lok Sabha, the lower house of parliament. If you cross that, you have a majority. And last time around, the BJP by itself managed to pull in 303 seats. And it was even campaigning for a much larger victory this time, but ended up with 240 seats. So about 32 are under a majority itself. That didn't mean it had to cobble together a coalition at the last minute. It had pre-election allies that put it over at 293 seats. But it's the first time Modi has to deal and rely on those coalition allies to govern. And on the other side, the opposition, which had been considered a bit aimless, full of infighting and not able to really have a pitch for the Indian electorate, managed to get 234 seats. This is the India Alliance, which is led by the Congress Party, but is a coalition of 28 parties from across the country. And they did far better than was expected.
And in the India coalition, were there any particular winners?
The Congress, the traditional party on that side, brought in 99 seats, up from 52 last time around. It's clearly the big player in that.
We should just remind people that Congress was famously the party of the Gandhi family, wasn't it?
Yes, and remains so. Its leader is Rahul Gandhi, who will now become leader of the opposition. Yes, it was Nehru's party and Indira Gandhi's party before him.
This election was held over 6 weeks and involved hundreds of millions of voters. So what was the turnout in the end?
Yeah, something like 970 million eligible voters. Turnout ended up being something like 65.8%. 2 percentage points lower than 2019 elections. It's been called a low turnout election, relatively speaking, because Indians had been used to turnout just increasing election after election, with maybe the striking bit being that fewer first-time voters than many expected. So in the previous two elections, you had a lot more folks who had just become eligible to vote over the previous 5 years turning up in droves, and this time only about 40% of them turned out to vote.
And this correlates to younger voters, essentially.
Yes.
Louise, if I told you a couple of months ago, if I predicted to you that the BJP would actually lose its majority in this last election, what would you have said to me?
I think I would have said that that would be quite a surprising outcome. But I also know that I would have hedged that answer with a lot of caveats. Firstly, because predicting the outcome of Indian elections is always a bit of a fool's errand. You know, traditionally, Indian general elections have really been an aggregate of multiple regional contests happening around the country. So predicting the outcome at a national level has always been very difficult. But the other reason I would have hedged my bets is that this felt nothing like a normal election. In fact, it even felt quite odd to be following it as a political scientist. And that's because the playing field had been so stacked against the opposition that it was quite difficult to predict what might happen because of the uncertainty about the basic terrain on which the elections are being fought.
Stacked how?
Well, we saw in the early days of the campaign the sitting opposition chief minister of Delhi being imprisoned on corruption charges. We saw the old electoral bond scheme, which had massively been stacked in favour of directing party funding towards the ruling party, all sorts of ways in the last 10 years, independent regulatory institutions, including the Election Commission of India, the key ombudsman for elections, under pressure and, you know, their independence in doubt. In all sorts of ways, it didn't feel like a level playing field, which meant it was much harder, really, to think about how to predict what the outcome might be.
The opposition India coalition, as we've just said, it really did, however, exceed expectations.
Massively. And so the fact that this pretty diverse band of opposition parties managed to agree a seat-sharing arrangement This is, you know, the process by which parties get together and decide which seats not to contest and allow their alliance partners to contest in order to prevent opposition disunity, you know, allowing the ruling party a kind of easy path to victory. And, you know, this includes in states where members of the National Opposition Alliance compete against each other. That was pretty remarkable in the first place. But then also that the alliance stuck together through the campaign was really very striking. And as Rohan has said, we see that in the results.
One of the things that has been a characteristic of the British election has been the emergence of this word supermajority. I also recall that Narendra Modi had made this statement that he wanted 400 seats out of the 543, I think, seats. Was that a good move?
I think that very much backfired against Modi, and the opposition really seized on that very cleverly to speak to fears about what the BJP might do with that kind of supermajority. And they connected it to this suggestion that an empowered BJP might seek to remove the constitutional provisions that provided affirmative action to India's lower castes and Dalit communities. And that really touched a nerve among the electorate.
Rohan, firstly, do you broadly agree with that? Also, can you find other reasons why the BJP struggled?
There's a clear sense that it backfired, that it was evident in the campaigning that happened from the opposition that pushing back and not giving them this massive majority was part of what was happening on the ground. There was a sense that the Modi phenomenon powered the BJP to uncharted territory in the last two elections, and they've been brought down to earth into an election that's much more about battles being played all across the pitch in this election, where many more local factors came into play rather than just Modi promising better days for Indians.
Louise, did it lose out more in some places than others? Were there any kind of big regional surprises?
Yes, there were. So the big story of the election kind of day was that the BJP had done much worse than expected in India's three largest states. So that's Uttar Pradesh in the north, which sends about 15%, I think, of MPs to parliament, and the state of Maharashtra and West Bengal, where the BJP had hoped to wrest power from the ruling regional party, and it failed to do that. Different reasons at play in all three of those places. But I think the results in UP and Uttar Pradesh were particularly significant, because what happened there was, firstly, the opposition had it together in terms of opposition unity. We saw a very interesting social coalition brought together there between Muslims, Dalits and lower castes. And that coalition was able to take head on the politics of Hindutva, of Hindu nationalism, in its heartland territory. And we have to remember that Uttar Pradesh is the home to the Ram Mandir, the temple to Ram that was built in Ayodhya and unveiled just at the beginning of this year. Everyone assumed that, you know, that really was the kind of the start of the election campaign when that inauguration took place. In fact, in the elections, the BJP even lost the seat in which the temple is located.
Rohan, that's really interesting, because when we talked about this before the election, it was explained how Modi and the BJP were mobilising a Hindu majority, essentially against what was seen as the depredations of the minorities, ending 1,000 years of slavery, which also included the last few years of independence. But this doesn't seem to have worked. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. There was clearly the effort to represent that temple as being a symbol of a new India either was just taken as a given by the people or was not enough to get people out to come and vote. Modi took an even harsher turn after we spoke as the campaign got going, potentially because they realized they were not doing well in the early rounds of voting. Modi decided to make it much more about taking on the Muslim minority, made a much sharper Hindu nationalist pitch over the course of the election. But even that, as Louise mentioned, even in some of its core territories that it had expected to do extremely well, it has suffered significantly. And so one can say that it's been arrested. Now, there are places where they picked up nearly every seat in other bits of North India. So it's not that there's a simple, straightforward storyline that India's voted against that kind of Hindu nationalism, but it certainly isn't as successful as it has been in the past for them.
Ram, when we looked at this last time, we knew the BJP, though it didn't need to, was in a coalition, but essentially it had all the power. Now, this time, it apparently needs to be in a coalition. So what kind of coalition has Modi negotiated and what kind of changes has that meant for him?
So the important thing here is that it's not a post-election coalition. These were his allies going into the election. And so it was not a scramble at the very end to find, you know, enough allies to take you over the edge. They have 293 seats, so a slim majority with these allies on board. Modi has never had to govern in this way, whether when he was a chief minister in Gujarat or in his previous two terms as prime minister, he's never had to deal with allies who he's dependent on to stay in government. So far, the effort has been made to signal continuity in parliament this week. He's made it very clear that he sees this as a third mandate for his government. They've kept the cabinet by and large the same. So we don't yet know how this is going to alter Modi's operations, but it's inevitable that there's going to be a more consultative, deliberative process at the top. Whether that happens in front or behind closed doors, that remains for us to see.
Louise, in that program, we talked about the possibility of a Modi landslide, meaning that he would be much bolder in some of the moves that he was going to take. Is it the case that actually now he's going to have to be more cautious? And maybe you'd take us through some of the bolder moves he might have made that you think he might now not.
Yeah, so I think bold moves are going to be much harder. Modi 1.0 and 2.0, the first two terms, a lot of unilateral decision-making made within the Prime Minister's office and around the Prime Minister's office. That's now going to be more difficult for two reasons. Firstly, the coalition dynamics that Rohan's just set out, but also the strength of the opposition. India, for the first time in 10 years, has an official opposition, and that's really important. They've just been sworn in. Rahul Gandhi's just been sworn in as leader of the opposition. You can already feel that the temperature in Parliament has changed over the last week. There's going to be a lot more scrutiny in Parliament as to what the government are doing. Some of the things we talked about, I think, in the last programme were the possibility of something like the Uniform Civil Code, which would involve creating a universal set of personal laws, removing currently the right of religious communities to govern their own personal laws for things like marriage, divorce, and so on. That will now have to be negotiated by coalition partners, and they have made clear that that's not something that they will accept unconditionally. The BJP had been keen to introduce something called simultaneous elections, which would mean having all elections in India on the same day, something that which many regional parties were quite unhappy about because, you know, they presume it would lead to a more nationalised political environment. Again, something like that, which would require a constitutional amendment, will become more difficult. What we don't know is what happens on economic policy. We've really seen economic discontent driving voters away from the BJP in these elections. And how bold this government might be in terms of economic and social policy, I think, is a key thing to watch.
Rohan, that raises a very interesting problem for the Modi government. I mean, the way in which we talked about it last time, it was this: the more difficult things became economically, the more he was likely to rely upon, if you like, the Hindu card. Do you think things are likely to become more difficult for him economically, or he has the capacity to solve the problems? And if so, do you think there's going to be more Hindu card?
It's undoubtedly the biggest challenge for India across the board, dealing with unemployment particularly. And that remains a gigantic challenge that, of course, the central government alone can't do by itself. To the Hindu card, one thing to remember is that the electoral calendar is always turning in India. Later this year, one of those states that Louise mentioned, Maharashtra, the state where Mumbai is located, is also going to elections. The BJP will be in election mode again as we go closer to it. Maybe the lesson it will learn from this election is that the Hindu card has not worked and it will have to find a more sellable economic argument. Maybe it will rely less on controversial socio-cultural issues and focus more on some grand economic promise of jobs, of creating more skill development and things like that. A budget is expected later in July. And as I said, elections are again around the corner. And so we'll have a sense pretty soon.
Ryan Venkat and Louise Tillin. My thanks to them and to David Everett and Ayesha Omar. The Briefing Room will be back next week with the first programme in a special series about health. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight and Caroline Bailey. The editor was Richard Barden and the studio engineer was Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Communicating with me, Ros Atkins. This is the podcast where I talk to some of the best communicators, like legendary magazine editor Tina Brown, the Olympic athlete and broadcaster Michael Johnson, to find out why good communication really matters and how best to do it. Have you ever walked out of a meeting and thought, why didn't I make the impact that I'd intended to? Or perhaps you put down the phone to the bank without getting the answer you wanted. We all have dozens of interactions every day, and this series will provide you with practical advice for communicating effectively during them. Communicating with Ros Atkins. Listen and subscribe on BBC Sounds.